Good morning, and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Thursday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. Later in today's program, we'll be talking about Governor Cuomo's, I can't say surprising, but I should, announcement yesterday regarding tax cuts and the constitutional amendment on casino gambling that New Yorkers will be voting on next month. But before we do that, we have a very special guest.
Good morning. This is Brian McDonnell, and I'd like to welcome our guest, U.S. Representative Paul Tonko, to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Congressman Tonko, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We got him. Paul, good morning. Congressman, are you there?
Good morning.
How are you this morning, Congressman?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Well, we don't have nearly as much going on here as you have going on down there. Paul, can you help us make sense of what's going on down in the District of Columbia?
Oh, I wish I could. I got to tell you, there is such a straightforward solution here to go forward and have government funded, have the doors open, the lights brought on. It's by adopting, passing a clean CR, a continued resolution, which could give us time then to go back to regular order and do with subcommittees and committees and full floor votes a real budget. And instead, we're sitting here held hostage. America's economy is held hostage. And now, in all of the foolishness of it, they want to release one hostage at a time by perhaps doing parks or perhaps doing NIH. You know, we need a real budget. We need a real CR. A clean CR can get us out of this mess within minutes on the floor. There are enough bipartisan support votes, and there are enough votes in the Senate and the House to make it happen.
This is Ron Deutsch. I also want to welcome you, my favorite congressman, to the
show. Thank you, Ron.
I guess I've been watching Fox News lately, and don't hold that against me. I guess I'm a bit of a masochist, but
I think we all need to watch what they're saying so that we have an opportunity to correct some of the misinformation.
Well, I'm going to give you that opportunity in just a second. So, you know, if you listen to Fox News, basically what they're saying is that the president will not negotiate with the House. You know, the president won't sit down. He won't talk to us about these issues. You know, he's intractable on this health care issue, which they're trying, obviously, to wedge into this debate. But so how do you respond to that? Should the president sit down and negotiate with, this kind of extreme wing of the House?
You know, I think they have very little reason to object here. They know that the Senate produced a number for a CR. The president and his administration produced a number, and the House did. The House came up with the smallest number, the lowest number. And now we're adopting that lowest number with the CR that takes us into the next few weeks, couple of months worth of continued resolution. So they already got concession. They got what they wanted. They've got their number, but they refused to take yes for an answer.
Well, what are continuing resolutions?
It's a whole deal of misinformation and disingenuous behavior to suggest that you need yet Obamacare, as they call it, to be part of the package. This is unprecedented that you would take a law, a three-year-old law, on the books and attempt to repeal it as a negotiating stance on what should be a clean, no bells and whistles attached, CR that moves us forward and funds government, and then in the next step has us pay our bills. This is totally brinksmanship on their behalf. And you know what really galls me? When we're on the floor debating this issue, they keep calling it a bill. It's not a bill. It's a law. And, you know, to have this, and they say this on Fox, that we will, you know, people are calling our office saying we're not sure we support the bill. I said it's been law for 3 years.
Paul, what is a continuing resolution? What's a clean continuing resolution or clean CR? And how long should this first clean CR be for?
Well, we would like it to go to November 15th. I think that buys us enough time. It will give us a month and a half to sit down, name conferees for each of the caucuses, for the majority and minority, for the Republicans and Democrats in the House and in the Senate, come to the conference table, and let in public air the differences, and I think that would be a very healthy exchange. So if we can buy that time, a CR is basically taking the budget proper, adjusting it downward or upward for some negotiated purpose, and giving it a green light for those several weeks ahead. So we say take it to November 15th, buy us the time to name conferees, the panelists to the conference table, and have these appointed people from the ranks of the elected represent their caucus, Democrat or Republican, at the table. And a clean CR is without any of the attempts to add bells and whistles, like repealing the Affordable Care Act. It is just bogging down negotiations. You don't go now and suggest with sour grapes or dislike for the law or dislike for the personality, in this case the president, to want to change things. You had in the president's first term the Affordable Care Act voted upon by the Senate and the House, and they approved it. He signed it into law. It then was tested by the highest court in the land. The Supreme Court gave it its thumbs up on constitutionality, on responding and being in sync with the Constitution. And then it was retested in a reelection campaign where candidate Governor Romney and candidate vice presidential candidate Representative Ryan made it very clear they were for repeal of Obamacare. And the public again said, no, by a large count, we are going to stay with the president. So it's been sanctioned. It's been approved time and time again. And you don't now say, well, I don't like the results of the election. Now, I think it was Senator McCain that said, hey, elections have consequences. And while I may not like this, I was out there at several stops asking for the repeal. The people have spoken, and this is, you know, the highest order of brinksmanship to now try to attach bells and whistles, meaning a law that is 3 years old, that's been tested, as I just suggested, many times over, and then now to play with the American economy and with the defunding or the shutdown of government is just irresponsible, reckless behavior.
Well, maybe, Congressman, they think, you know, 44 times a charm, right? You know, try one more time to defund Obamacare.
Well, you know, it's a good point, right? How many times, Ron, do you want to attempt to repeal and be denied?
Right.
You know, if you do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results, some define that as insanity.
Yeah, I would, too. I would ask you, though, I think, you know, people don't seem to realize the impact that the shutdown is having. I called the EPA the other day, the regional office, nobody there. Everybody's been furloughed right now. There's a lot of federal workers who are out of work right now.
Small business loans
right. That
aren't being processed, appeals by veterans, Social Security requests, sign-ups for new folks on Social Security. I mean, this is a major impact to quality of life, to people that I represent. You know, people are saying, well, look at the pain and look at the anger. And so there's pain and anger galore all over. I'm angry about this effort that we have said, let's do a clean CR. It is not that difficult. Republicans in the United States Senate are calling on the Republican majority in this House, do a clean CR. A few Republicans in the House have now broken away from their leadership saying, let's do a clean CR. So the momentum is building. While every day, more and more in the millions are getting online to shop with the Obamacare. So it's ironic that the issue that they have made prominent in their negotiation struggle is now getting a favorable response, an aggressive response, a voluminous response from the American public. So these two trains coming down the tracks at the same time here are speaking with one voice, in a sense, and still the efforts by Senator Cruz and Tea Party Republicans who are acting irresponsibly and recklessly just don't seem to hear the message.
Congressman, we seem to be careening from crisis to crisis with this Republican-led Congress. So you mentioned that there might be a few moderate Republicans willing to peel off. What's got to happen before this Republican-led Congress wakes up and starts to put the interests of the American people ahead of the interests of a few Tea Party followers?
Right. Sadly, I think it's going to be the public decrying the process, decrying the outcome, explaining to each of us what the hurt factor is. I mean, several of us get that, and we're sensitive to it. I got to believe everyone gets it that serves here, that they understand there's pain and consequence. It's just, at what point do you begin to empathize, and at what point do you feel responsible so as to move forward and say a clean CR does it? It does it in a hurry. It would be whisked through because people would approve it, I believe, and then move to the president's desk.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with U.S. Representative Paul Tonko, who represents a good chunk of the Capital Region, including the city of Troy, where we're located here at WRPI Troy. Paul, has the House of Representatives voted on a clean CR in any way already?
Well, we have attempted to. We've had the Senate send over a clean CR, but you know the majority in the House has put together a CR with this lower number, but they don't bring their bills to the floor. They have not brought their transportation bill to the floor. They have these very low numbers, and it tells me they don't have the votes for what they put together. They looked like they wanted to go really low with the number, and then I think they have a number of moderate Republicans who say, I can't live with this, so they don't bring it to the floor. And that's why we're imploring them, do this CR with your number, and once we do that, we're home free. Government is reopened, and we can move on to the next order of business. Begin to name the conferees. I have asked since April for the leadership through written form with my colleagues saying, please, now that all the entities have defined their budget and approved it in their respective houses, and the president has done it with his administration, let's go forward now and vote on that CR. Let's go forward and do the budget.
Have there been any record votes, even on a procedural matter, where the House majority has voted against bringing a clean CR to the floor? Or have they avoided going on record?
We had a procedural thing yesterday asking for a clean CR, and if that had passed as a procedural vote, we would have moved to the CR, but it didn't pass. We had a press conference yesterday imploring them to come to the House and do the clean CR. So, you know, we'll continue to do this. We'll continue to echo that alarm, and I got to believe eventually enough people will start to peel off.
How are the Republicans in the New York congressional delegation doing?
Well, you know, Peter King has tried to develop a surge here of breaking away from this resistance, and we'll see how that goes. There are some people still sticking with the strategy of a negotiated bill that the Republicans want to do that includes repeal or denial or delay of Obamacare, and you know that whole effort is still their control thing. It's, I think, the Speaker responding to the tail wagging the dog in the House, a virtual minority within the majority of the House, within their network, has paralyzed the process because they threaten moderate Republicans with a primary challenge. And I just think that this is unacceptable behavior, and it's really producing a lot of damage out there for our communities and our families.
On the procedural vote that you talked about yesterday to try to bring a clean CR up for a vote, how did the Republicans do generally, and did any Republicans vote against it?
I would have to go back and verify this, but I'm almost certain it was along party line.
So no one has broken ranks that much yet?
No, No, but they are talking the virtues of a clean CR. So I think if we keep igniting here, if we keep bringing to everyone's attention and calling and requesting and challenging for a vote, it, I think, is going to happen.
Yeah, it is sad that such a small minority in the House is really holding all this up and holding the American people hostage at this point. Yeah, it really does. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I was watching the news last night, and this was the real news, that I saw that you were in solidarity with furloughed federal workers. You decided you were not going to take your paycheck because apparently, you know, while other folks aren't getting paid, members of Congress continue to get paid. But I think it was you and Representative Maloney were basically saying, hey, we're not going to take our pay as long as government shut down and other folks aren't getting paid.
I've made a request to have my check withheld until the process is done. And, we'll continue to do that. I said, we're not going to stop working. We're working it to the nth degree. But there's a great number of people. I just talked to some neighbors here in my neighborhood in D.C., that are federal employees. One whose husband is at NIH, at the National Institute of Health, getting cancer treatment. And he's been critically ill over the past year. He's in with a bit of a need right now. And the nurses working with him, who are excellent, who are consummate professionals, are not getting paid as they're doing their work.
Congressman, I feel like we're in a very difficult spiral to break out of. So we look forward to the 2014 election, so maybe some of these Republicans can be penalized by the voters. But many of these districts that they come from were so terribly gerrymandered after the 2010 redistricting around the country that they're actually rewarded for showing this bad behavior in Congress. How do we break out of this cycle?
Well, unfortunately, it's probably going to be, again, enough public information exchange with facts, not fiction, and keep loading that in these districts. I got to believe, even though they're skewed to their political philosophy and their partisanship, I got to believe that many of these districts are also including a population of individuals in need. And when they understand what's happening, they'll eventually respond in the negative. And then absent that, I think working the population in these districts is important. But then also, in the next go-around of census and redistricting, there has got to be a reform that finds a much fairer process and doesn't create these pockets that are so safe a seat that you get these opportunities where extreme thinking and reckless and irresponsible behavior can really be maximized.
Now that we have the impasse over the beginning of the fiscal year, it's not many weeks before we have the next hurdle of the debt limit being hit. Is it possible that we might see the country go that far over a cliff and not extend the debt limit?
Well, there are those who now want to tie the debt limit to this debate and get it all resolved in one fell swoop. While that's nice and could perhaps put more pressure on the effort to get it done, I really get very concerned about, a shutdown is bad enough, but an economic impact to the fiscal situation of this country by a credit degrading, would be tremendous as a blow to our economy, where people would pay more for car loans and mortgages, and credit card rates would go up, and what the price tag is for borrowing for individual states would be tinkered with. I mean, this would put a major dent into the economy, which I think would be severely, severely felt.
But I wonder, Congressman, if people like Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Rand Paul, I mean, the real wingnuts of the party who are looking to run to the very far right for their presidential primary, I wonder if anyone could persuade them to see reason.
Well, everyone is trying at this point, and I know one thing, a great furor is coming forth from the Republican Party for those who followed the Cruz leadership, and they're coming down on him now because they understand he didn't have an exit strategy. He just knew to get into a fight and didn't know how to close that fight. And they're very angry now because they bought into a process that really didn't have a favorable bit of strategy here.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we have been speaking with the Honorable Paul Tonko, who represents all of Albany and Schenectady counties and parts of Montgomery, Saratoga, and Rensselaer counties, including the city of Troy, where WRPI is located. He represents us in the U.S. House of Representatives. Representative Tonko, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
My pleasure. And, hey, let's wish us all the best of luck, too.
Yeah, good luck
to you. Good luck, Congressman.
Get government reopened and solve the debt ceiling limit, pay our bills, and move on and do a real budget in regular order so that we can bring to the public from coast to coast the real contrast in what people are offering between the Republican majority and the Democratic minority in the House.
Best wishes.
Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you.
Congressman.
Take care, gentlemen.
Right. That was the Honorable Paul Tonko, who represents all of Albany and Schenectady counties and parts of Montgomery and Saratoga and Rensselaer counties, including the city of Troy, in the U.S. House of Representatives. Representative Tonko has been gracious enough to join us on The People's Business several times, and we greatly appreciate it. We're going to switch now from federal issues to New York State issues. A month from now, on November 5th, New Yorkers who take the time to go to the polls will be voting on a constitutional amendment to authorize an expansion of casino gambling in New York State. The voting on referenda is very interesting in New York State because not everyone who actually shows up at the polls bothers to vote yes or no. As many as a million people in an election that might have 2.8 to 3 million people voting, as many as a million of the people who actually take the time to go to the polls then don't vote yes or no on the ballot questions. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. New York does not have a lot of referenda the way California does, for example. This particular November 5th, the voters will be voting on six constitutional, the voters who vote, who go to the polls and who vote yes or no on the questions, will be voting on six constitutional amendments. The first one of the six is a constitutional amendment to authorize an expansion of casino gambling in New York State. Last month here on The People's Business, my co-hosts Ron Deutsch and Brian McDonnell and I spoke with State Senator John Bonasek, who supports that proposed amendment, and we spoke with Albany Attorney Neil Murray, who opposes it. We also spoke with Daniel Hunter, the author of a new book, Strategy and Soul, about the debate over casino gambling in Pennsylvania. Now, for an additional perspective on casino gambling, Ron, Brian, and I are pleased to be joined on the telephone by James Featherston Haw, an Albany lawyer, and the president of the New York Gaming Association. Jim, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It's great to be with you, Frank.
Jim, what is the New York Gaming Association?
Well, the New York Gaming Association is an association that has been formed by all nine New York racetrack casinos, which are currently operating in the state, running all the way from the casino down in Queens at Aqueduct out to Batavia.
And we're going to talk about the casino gambling amendment, and you and your association have been active in the debate. I'm assuming, but I just want to make it clear before I make too many assumptions or our co-hosts Ron and Brian do, but I assume you're supporting the amendment that's on the ballot.
We are supporting the amendment. We supported the enabling legislation that passed with the amendment, and we have supported both the first and second passage of that referendum, and we support the passage of the referendum by the people this November.
The wording of the proposed amendment has become controversial, and we'll get to that later, but let's start with the economics. The proposed amendment, if adopted, would add the following words, quote, and accept casino gambling at no more than seven facilities as authorized and prescribed by the legislature, end quote. It would add that language to the list of activities that are currently in the Constitution as being exempt from New York State's prohibition on gambling. The current exceptions include paramutual betting on horse racing and a state-operated lottery. The governor's plan for implementing this constitutional amendment, the implementing legislation that our guest Jim Featherston Hall referred to, was agreed to by the legislature and involves citing four of these seven casinos in the early years of implementation. Jim, for the level of capital invested that the state is requiring or anticipating for these facilities, for these four facilities, how much betting volume would they need to have in order to make the return on investment that firms in this industry need?
Well, it would differ in each of the locations. The initial calls for the siting of four casinos in three regions. So obviously one region will receive two casinos. The tax rates in each of those regions is a little bit different. So the volume of gross gaming revenue necessary to support a level of investment that would be required for somebody to win one of these things, although there's no magic number, it's going to be in the eye of the siting committee as to what the best bid is. But it would be different in each of the regions, Frank. It would certainly be substantial, and I would think between the regions it might range from a total capital investment of $200 million to a capital investment of as much as $500 to $700 million, most likely down in that Catskill region.
Right. You mentioned that the tax rates vary among the region. Just to repeat, the three regions where these initial four casinos will be sited are the Capital Region, where we are, the Catskills-Hudson Valley, which includes the traditional resort area of Sullivan County in the Catskills, as well as other Hudson Valley counties. But it doesn't include, as I understand it, the immediate suburban counties of Westchester, Rockland, and Putnam.
That's correct. It goes as far as Orange County, and that's where it stops.
And the third region is the what they're referring to as the Eastern Southern Tier, which is basically focused in Broome and Tioga counties. You mentioned that the tax...
Well, that's true, although that also runs all the way up to around the Auburn area. That is a long and it's kind of a boot-shaped district.
Wow. You mentioned that the tax rates vary by region. What's the range? What's the lowest tax rate and what's the highest tax rate?
The highest is here in the Capital Region, where the basic slot range would be 45%. And don't hold me to this, but I think in that Southern Tier region it goes down to 37, and I think it's 39 in the Catskill region.
So 45 or 37% of what? What is it a percentage
that
of?
That would be a percentage of the slot drop.
Does that mean the gross betting?
No, it doesn't mean the amount bet. That's gross gaming revenue. And most of that money goes back to the players, obviously.
Right.
So the tax rate is applied to the win or the amount of money that the gamers ultimately lose, and it goes to the casinos.
Right. So that's the tax rate is on the difference between the gross betting minus the return that the bettors get. So it's
right.
I think you said it a good way. What the people lose is what gets taxed.
That's correct.
Okay.
All right, let me. This is Ron Deutsch, and I also want to welcome our guest Jim Featherstone to the People's Business here on WRPI, Troy. Jim, under the governor's current plan, which obviously has been endorsed by the legislature, you know, what's the default scenario? So basically, in other words, you know, what happens if voters say no rather than yes on November 5th?
Well, if the voters say no, the thing that would the most dramatic thing that would happen is the aid provisions to local government would go away, so that the local governments in these regions would not be receiving a share of the revenue as they would under the governor's plan. There is a provision that would allow the Gaming Commission to site not full-blown commercial casinos, but to site additional video lottery terminal parlors in each of the regions. But under that scenario, the local governments in the region would receive no revenue.
Right. So let me ask you this then. So if that's the default scenario, and let's say it, for some reason it doesn't pass, what does that mean for an area like Saratoga? So in the Capital District, we already have a Racino that has video lottery terminals. Would there be an allowance for another one? Would it be an expansion of the current one? How would that play out?
Well, that would be ultimately up to the Gaming Commission, but I think as it was contemplated, it would contemplate citing an additional one in some other location within the, I think we have an 8-county region of video lottery terminals, and there would be a public bidding process to get someone to come in and operate the facility.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, Jim Featherston-Haw, to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Jim, now that we have a basic idea as to what the proposed constitutional amendment would do and what would happen if it's defeated, can you tell us why you think it would be a good idea for state's voters to say yes when they go to the polls on November 5th?
I think yes, I'll be glad to. I mean, this is one of the most obviously beneficial pieces of legislation, in this case constitutional amendments, that I've seen in 40 years of watching the government. First of all, it changes very little. The governor said, and he said accurately, and you all know because you live in the Capital District, we already have commercial gambling all over New York State. The 5 full-blown Native American commercial casinos, the 9 racetrack casinos. If you want to go gamble tonight, and I hope you do, we'd be happy to host you up at Saratoga. And when you walk onto that floor, the feel of that floor will be almost identical to the feel of the Bellagio floor when you walk onto it in Las Vegas. So we already have gambling in New York. Because we can't offer all of the kinds of entertainment that some other states have, about $3 billion is spent by New Yorkers in Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, some in Las Vegas, Ohio, in surrounding states, in Canada, and that money is taxed by those jurisdictions and goes to support schools in Pennsylvania and Ohio, Connecticut, and these other jurisdictions. It seems almost silly that New Yorkers wouldn't want to both make the gambling more convenient for those people who want to do it, and we understand not everybody does, but both more convenient and keep the fruits of that entertainment industry here at home to support New York.
We're speaking with Jim Featherston-Haw, who's a lawyer and lobbyist in Albany, and who also is the president of the New York Gaming Association, which is a trade association of the racetrack-based casinos that currently operate in New York, such as it's at the Saratoga Harness Track in this area, and also now at Aqueduct in Queens. Of the three billion dollars in betting that goes to New Jersey, Connecticut, and elsewhere right now, how much of that $3 billion is anticipated would transfer to New York if it had these four casinos?
Well, you'll get differing estimates from differing experts, which is not surprising in the business of economics. But we would expect to repatriate or to bring back to New York upon the full, when all four commercial casinos are operational, something on the order of $1.4 billion of that money.
Right. And then
it would depend a little bit on where they're located, too, obviously.
Right. So the one in the Catskills will be near New Jersey and then metro area. The one in the southern tier, or as you point out,
that'll be near Pennsylvania, where it's currently getting beaten up because of some of the Pennsylvania casinos right on the other side of the state line. In that Catskill region also, depending again on where it's located, somebody could locate one quite close to the Connecticut border, up in the Orange County area, and attract a lot of people from Connecticut who are now and keep New Yorkers who are now going to Mohegan Suns and Foxwoods back here in New York.
Right. So if 1.4 billion of the 3 billion that's currently bet by New Yorkers in other states was bet in New York, does the 3 billion include amount that New Yorkers spend in Las Vegas, or is it just what they spend in the neighboring states?
No, it includes spend in Las Vegas also.
Right. So if 1.4 billion of the 3 billion comes back to New York, how much more betting would there have to be to make the operation work from an economic perspective? How much increase in betting would there have to be?
You mean how much of an increase would you need over the in addition
to the 1.4?
To the 1.4?
Yeah.
Well, that goes back to the other answer I gave you, Frank, which is not very exact, but it's completely true. It would depend a little bit on the capital expenditure originally made by the casino operators and the location. But in fact, I would think that, again, depending on location and the size of the facilities, you wouldn't need much more. I mean, you will get more gaming, or you would expect to get more gaming from the current population in New York. But most of that additional gaming will come from people who are currently choosing because they like table games or they like additional amenities that aren't available without having the table games. And so they go. You know, you can get to these casinos outside New York very quickly, very easily.
Will some of the betting, besides coming from facilities outside New York, come from the existing racinos in New York and the existing Indian casinos?
I would guess. There was certainly, if you increase the competitive landscape, there'll be some migration of players back and forth, for sure.
Will it affect the state lottery?
Well, the lottery, which is the biggest lottery in the country, currently, from the racinos and that portion of the lottery, this year will get a little over a billion dollars. We do not believe, and in fact, most of the studies that people have done would show that casino gambling is not particularly competitive with lottery sales. So no, I don't think it's going to hurt your instant tickets or your scratch-offs, and certainly not going to hurt the Mega Millions or those big jackpots. It is more likely that And remember, because of the education formulas, this money is all accretive. It's not as if it takes money away from the lottery and then it doesn't go to education, because 80% of the money the state gets from the new facilities will go to education. So I would expect that state revenues for education would grow, would be increased by about $250 million.
That's an interesting estimate. Let me ask you this, Jim, since we only have a few minutes left here in this segment. I wanted to ask you, you know, because you've been talking about the benefits of this casino expansion and gaming expansion in New York, but I guess there's a lot of critics out there that would say that the benefits aren't great enough to outweigh some of the costs, whether they're the social costs of potentially increased crime, increased poverty. You know, we go to Atlantic City and we take one step off the boardwalk and it, you know, looks like a bombed out area somewhere. And it's not doing well economically off the boardwalk. But do you foresee any of that happening in New York? And how would you answer the critics that say that the social concerns outweigh the revenue needs?
Well, first of all, I would say that it's easy to say that, but it's difficult to demonstrate it, particularly in New York, where gaming has been rolled out in a very careful, thoughtful, and effective manner. It's true that if you step one foot off the boardwalk in Atlantic City, because of the cluster of the casinos and the way they've sited them, that they ruined their downtown area behind it, and you can see that in some other places. But I would invite all of you to come to the Saratoga Casino, take one step off of it, and you'll be in one of the truly great little cities in America. It has been an enhancement to the city. If you take a look at Tioga, that's the one in the southern tier down near Binghamton, you'll see the same thing. You can check statistically. There has been no increase in crime as a result of the Racino being located there. A lot of that has to do with location and locating gaming facilities in a sensible, effective place where they don't cause social problems. So I hear people make that argument, but they make it in a generic way. I've never heard anybody make that argument effectively in terms of New York gaming.
It sounds like one of the things might be that places like the Saratoga Racino are not in urban areas, are not in urban downtowns.
I believe that is one of the important differentiations.
Right. This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've been speaking with Jim Featherston-Hall, an Albany lawyer and lobbyist and the president of the New York Gaming Association. Jim, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It was great to be with you guys. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Oh, we greatly appreciate that. Jim Featherston-Hall, the New York Gaming Association's website is newyorkgamingallstrungtogether.org, and his lawyer and lobbyist website is www.fwc-law.com.
You are listening to The People's Business, which is a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Thursday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's legislative and political director, and I'm joined here in the studio by Ron Deutsch, who's the executive director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness, and Frank Morrow, who's the executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute.
Pleasure to be with you.
Happy to have you here. Now, as I was going through my clips yesterday, Ron, I noticed that you and Frank put out a pretty negative statement about an announcement that Governor Cuomo made yesterday morning at Manhattanville College down in Westchester County. So what did the governor say that got you and Frank so worked up?
We never put out negative statements about anything the governor says, Brian. We only put out factual statements. But no, I think
so. That's like Harry Truman. They said, I don't give him hell. I just tell him the truth, and they think it's hell.
That's right. The governor doesn't like to hear the truth, apparently. But, you know, I think this is one of those politically motivated moves on the part of the governor to kind of change the nature of the debate right now. So let's talk a little bit about what happened. So yesterday, the governor announced the creation of a new tax commission. Just about 10 months after the creation of the old tax commission. We'll call the old tax commission the tax commission, and then the new tax commission the tax quomission, since it seems to be focused entirely on the needs of the governor. But he basically appointed former Governor George Pataki, the governor that beat his dad for his final run in office, to head up a tax commission that is charged with ostensibly cutting taxes in New York State. The governor is saying property taxes, but really the charge, I think, is all taxes, and in particular business taxes will be the focus. And he basically is shelving or mothballing his original tax commission. And I think the whole point of this is, as you guys know, there's been a kind of a furor lately in terms of tax cuts, right? We heard the governor start making rumblings about the need for tax cuts. The Senate certainly jumped on that bandwagon. They started holding hearings across New York State, rather stilted hearings, I would add, where they were really just hearing from the business community as to what business tax cuts people wanted and what regulatory changes people wanted. So not to be outdone, our governor decided he was going to form his own tax cutting commission now, which really is the same as the original tax commission. But I think what's going on here is really the fact that I think the original tax commission was not going to be releasing a report or recommendations, rather, that jived with exactly what the governor wanted and the direction the governor was moving in politically. Would you agree with that, Frank?
That's our guess. I think that's a very likely outcome of what was happening. And I think the governor, in effect, framed the issue in a way that, if that diagnosis is correct that Ron and I have, it's of the governor's own making. Because when he created the Tax Reform and Fairness Commission in December of 2012, delivering on a promise he had made in December of 2011. Before. So it took a while to get around to it. But what he said at the time is he wanted them to do a comprehensive review of the tax system, to look just not just at fairness, but also simplicity and also the overall effect on economic development. So virtually the whole McGillivray taxes. He wanted them to come with ideas for reducing the tax burden, but to do it in a way that was revenue neutral. And so how could you make the system fairer and reduce the tax burden by making it revenue neutral? Because in that same announcement in December 2012, he said he wanted them to focus on eliminating loopholes, what academics call tax expenditures, special breaks, credits, deductions that are really for particular industries or very specialized type of behavior. So the governor created this commission in December of 2012 and said he wanted it to be revenue neutral. And so they were taking that charge seriously, and they were looking at ways to make the system fairer, to focus on getting rid of tax breaks that weren't economically effective, producing a reduction in tax burden, tax rates in some cases, for people. We don't know what they would have proposed, but we were hoping it focused on middle-income people and low-income people and focused on the property tax burden. But the governor phrased that. But now it seems the governor has changed his mind. And for I don't know if the governor has said this himself, but in the New York Daily News article yesterday morning that sort of broke this surprise announcement.
I can love it.
A source close to Carl McCall, former controller who's co-chairing the commission, said that the governor feels that because revenues are coming in strongly, that the state can afford a $2 to $3 billion tax cut this coming year. And we assume that means a $2 to $3 billion revenue reduction, which we just because revenues are coming in strongly right now doesn't mean when you have significant commitments on the books that you haven't been able to meet, like the settlement of the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit, and that we've been starving school districts instead and giving them minuscule increases in state aid, that you say, oh, well, revenues are coming in strongly, therefore we can give the money back to the people.
Right.
We shouldn't keep it. But you have obligations that you have made that you're not honoring.
That's right. I mean, we have, you know, our cities in upstate New York and in parts of New York City are teetering on the brink of financial ruin, if you listen to the reports that are out there at this point. We also have, you know, in many of our upstate cities, child poverty rates of over 50%, which is just unbelievable to think about. We have record homelessness, record hunger in New York, yet somehow we can afford another $2 to $3 billion in tax cuts, which is just astounding to me. And then the other reality, which no one seems to be talking about, is we just passed $2 billion or so in tax cuts, which, you know, you and I both agree, Frank and Brian does as well, that they were just ridiculous tax cuts. You know, we're talking about the $350 family rebate check, which is going to come to your mailbox just before Election Day, ironically enough, but only if you are fertile and have children, apparently.
Well, only right? if you had a child dependent 2 years ago.
Right. And if your income doesn't exceed $300,000 a year, which apparently is the new middle class, or is not below $40,000 right. a year, because a person making $280,000 a year obviously needs that $350 more than someone making $28,000 a year.
Yeah, that raises a very interesting tax policy issue. So the state legislature, as part of this year's budget, passed a law which says for each of the next three Octobers, for three Octobers in a row, any taxpayer whose income was over $40,000 but less than $300,000, who had at least one dependent child 2 years earlier, and who had a tax liability of not less than zero, no. would get a check in the mail each October for $350. Now, they're saying that doesn't go to people below with incomes below $40,000, even if they have tax liability. So now, to put that together with a few other things, in the tax hearings that the state Senate has been holding around the state over the last few weeks, and they have one today, might be on Long Island at some place.
Yeah, Mineola, I think.
Right. And then they have one next week, I think, in New York City, next week or the week after. But Unshackle Upstate, which is an upstate business group, came up with a proposal that has a lot of flaws in it. But their focus was for upstate New York, that for counties that met certain criteria. One of the things wrong with their proposal is they would have different tax policy by county, depending on economic indicators. But leaving that aside, what they wanted to do is give a tax reduction to people whose incomes were below $50,000 a right. year.
An income tax reduction.
An income tax 25%. Reduction. But for people below $50,000. So put that together with what the governor and the legislature did. The governor and the legislature are giving a break to people above 40. Unshackle Upstate says the focus should be on people who are 50 and lower, acknowledging that most people in upstate New York don't have high incomes, and that people with incomes below 50, below 40, below 30 have to spend virtually all of their income to live. So the only overlap is 40 to 50, but the state legislature leaves out the people with incomes below 40. Now comes along the governor with his tax commission, and who does he appoint as the co-chair but former Governor George Pataki, who has always had as his favored tax policy the need to reduce the top effective rates on high incomes.
Right.
And he takes a real supply-side view. So it's directly contrary not only to good tax policy, but also to what Unshackle Upstate has finally figured out is the reality of upstate New York.
Right, and Pataki clearly presided over some of the biggest tax cuts in this state's history, which without question benefited the wealthiest and some of the biggest corporations in New York State. So I think the question is, do we want more of the same of that? And I think the public would absolutely say no. So when we start talking about delivering tax relief to people in need, I think, you know, we really have to be looking at those with lower incomes, working class families in New York State. And by far, the tax that they're hurt by the most, if they're hurt at all, is the property tax. So what's happened is, and Governor Pataki also reigned over this one, where he had like the greatest bait and switch tax policy our state's ever seen, where he basically put far less reliance on state taxes, which are based on ability to pay, and push the burden down to the property tax. So, you know, that's the problem right now, is we have this state-local fiscal relationship, which puts so much pressure on the property tax because the state is not holding up its end of the bargain.
Well, now, gentlemen, so that's a great segue to another bit of news that we've all been following. Since the last time we met in September, there was a primary in New York City. There is a mayor's race taking place, and the person who won the Democratic primary, Bill de Blasio, has made his whole campaign about a tale of two cities, that in New York City, particularly under Mayor Bloomberg, the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer.
Right.
Now, when de Blasio pointed out the income inequality had grown so much in New York City, Mayor Bloomberg's response was that, well, maybe we should have a few more billionaires move into New York City. That's the good thing. So clearly tax policy, right, in all parts of our state is being discussed. And as Ron says now, if 300,000 is the new middle class, then certainly the dynamic has changed for working families in New York State.
Yeah, one of the things I would say where I think there's a piece of good information in what Mayor Bloomberg's response is the fact, and I've looked at recent data, between 2000 and 2010, the number of people who file tax returns with income of $1 million or more has grown much faster in New York State than it has in the rest of the country. So in effect, you hear all this concern by people like Governor Pataki, who complain about the high marginal tax rates on the wealthy and claiming that'll make the wealthy leave.
Right.
When New York, as Mayor Bloomberg has pointed out and as the facts show, has a growing number of millionaires. Now, Governor, you know, Mayor Bloomberg says we'd like more, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, we are. Of course we want more.
But we need to have a fair tax policy. In fact, Mayor Bloomberg sort of acknowledges that because he says the presence of high-income people allows us to have the progressive tax system that covers the social safety net. Now, what he's not forgetting is, yes, it's true that New York has this unusual, New York, again, particularly New York City, has this unusual mix of wealth and poverty,
right,
and we have to have a fair tax policy and a viable social safety net. But we also have to be making investments in infrastructure and education so we eliminate the income inequality.
Right.
We can't say that the final solution is to have a safety net, an effective safety net. We need that, but we need to eliminate the need for the safety net.
Right. And as you point out, you know, critics are basically saying that there'll be this great migration of millionaires leaving New York State. But, you know, already the conservatives will say we have the highest tax burden in the country, whether it's federal and state combined. But apparently the number of millionaires keeps growing. So it doesn't look like millionaires are fleeing New York. It looks like they're coming to New York. And I believe that's because this is where they can make their millions. They're certainly not going to run to Mississippi.
And it isn't just the number of millionaires in New York isn't growing just because millionaires move to New York. It's also growing because people have a greater ability to become a millionaire in New York,
mm-hmm,
particularly in New York City, than becoming a millionaire elsewhere in the country. Brian, any thoughts you have on the election?
Well, so the polls have de Blasio leading by a large margin, but Joe Lota, who's the Republican nominee, is raising a lot of money. He's going to have plenty of money to get his message out. He's been taking money from the Koch brothers, who love to have their hand in all sorts of right-wing conservative races. They're already painting de Blasio as a Sandinista and a guy who traveled to Cuba at one point. So there's nothing that these folks will not say to try to defeat someone who has more progressive tax policy and other policies that he's supporting.
Right. Okay. They'll make the class warfare argument, too. Like, this is all about class warfare and punishing the job creators, which is just the biggest
bunch of
bunk.
Well, we don't want to punish anyone.
No, we're not punishing anybody.
And I think our tax, while we might have higher progressive tax rates in New York than many other states, it's not than all states. In California, just by referendum, went a further direction, but I think we have a good balance. This is Frank Morrow, director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. That's fiscalpolicy.org if you want to look at our work. And I'm here with Brian McDonald, the legislative and political director for AFSCME New York, and Ron Deutsch, the executive director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. Ron's work can be seen at www.abetterchoice4ny.org. And we thank you all for joining us here on WRPI Troy for the People's Business, a part of Capital District Progressive Radio. Please join us again on November 7th as we try to cast a little sunshine on the way in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. Now stay tuned for Democracy Now!